Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the part of your Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio when we aim to get you thinking. And I'm going to be doing that in the company of an atheist and Christian guest on today's programme. If you're interested in what's coming up later on today on Faith Explored, well, straight after today's programme between 4 and 5, you can hear Angie Lamar. She's a young, talented comedian. And she's going to be launching a new show on our sister station, Premier Gospel. So hear her on the profile between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. Don't forget that towards the end of today's programme, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of Unbelievable. And if you want to listen back to any past shows and see some of the comments that have been left under those programmes, don't forget we've got a fantastic new website. It's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. There's also links to videos, further resources and much more. And you can find today's programme there if you're listening on Saturday or thereafter. So what are we talking about on today's programme? Let me introduce my guests and the subject for today.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme we're asking, is religion based on unjustified belief, whereas science is based on evidence? Elliot George is a retired science teacher and an atheist. He's written a book called Godbuster, Exorcises All Known Gods. Well, in it, Elliot says that science is evidence-based, whereas Christianity and other religions are simply about belief. If that sounds familiar, you won't be surprised to know that he's influenced by people like Peter Boghossian, who, of course, has been a former guest on this programme. My other guest today, though, is Jonathan McClatchy. He's our Christian representative. He's a PhD student in cell biology, so he knows what he's talking about when it comes to that stuff. But he says Elliot's book is badly flawed and that Christian belief is evidence-based, and in fact science itself lends support to the case for God, for a creator. Gentlemen, welcome along to today's programme. Great to have you both with me in studio today. First of all, a warm welcome to you, Elliot.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, shall we say from the outset, this is a pen name, Elliot George.
Yes, it's a not very well-kept secret.
Obviously riffing on someone else who used a pen name for themselves, George Eliot. But talk to us about why, because it's to do with the fact that you are a science teacher by background. That's you're retired now, but you've obviously published other books. And so that was part of the reason why you wanted to keep this one a bit distinct.
Yes, I've published other books in my own name, and I don't want to spoil the market for them in areas where there's prejudice against atheism.
Okay. But we're going to refer to you anyway by your pen name today, Elliot. Tell us a little bit about your background. I think you sort of had a sort of nominal Christian upbringing, at least in terms of school education. But you've probably been an atheist pretty much for a long time, I'm guessing.
Yes. My parents were not ardent believers, but I did go to a Church of England primary school a long time ago now. And then I went to a grammar school where we had daily worship in assembly, and we had compulsory religious instruction lessons that were Bible-based.
Okay.
No other faiths involved. I also, briefly, sang for the choir of our parish church.
There you go. A claim to fame.
I wore the surplice and the cassock. And
you had the full regalia.
Yes.
Well done.
I was about nine, I think.
How long would you say you've been an atheist, though, or would you not even use that term necessarily? I don't know.
No, I don't like the word atheist. After all, we don't need a word for those of us who don't believe in UFOs, do we? I mean, there's no word a ufologist. You can't really group people together on the basis of what they don't
believe
have, they don't share.
Right.
So that's why I don't like the word atheist. I also don't like the word agnostic, because agnostic presumes that the existence of God is forever unknowable. And I don't have any evidence that that's the case. I mean, keep looking.
Right. Well, I suppose it could also mean that you simply are uncommitted personally.
So I prefer to describe myself as a non-believer.
Non-believer. Well, that'll do for today.
Thank you. Yes.
We could have a whole discussion on the terminology of atheists and agnostics and everything else, but no time for that today. We're going to be talking about your book and the issue of science and faith, and whether, as you claim, religion is sort of an unjustified form of belief. And we'll be talking about belief itself as well, because I think that's something you sort of particularly major on to some extent in the book. Welcome also, Jonathan McClatchy.
Thank you.
Jonathan, you're kind of quite well known in the sort of Christian apologetics blogosphere, because you do an awful lot of writing on quite a variety of subjects, actually. You seem to have an interest in New Testament history, Islam, but probably what you're best known for is biology, intelligent design, that kind of thing.
Right.
Do you want to just give us a little flavour into how you got so interested in those kinds of areas?
Sure. So I began my undergraduate training in forensic biology at the in 2007 at the University of Strathclyde in Scotland. And studying molecular biology and being exposed to the molecular world of the cell, I became very intrigued by these macromolecular machines and the information-bearing properties of DNA and RNA. And I came to the recognition, the more I study the world of the cell and the molecular basis of things which we take for granted, such as cell division and DNA replication and so forth, that these were the product not of stochastic, blind, undirected processes, but in fact were the product of intelligent agency. They had a rational mind which undergirded their origin. And so that was my introduction. I was often baffled, frankly, as an undergraduate, at how anyone could go through a four-year university or college program in biology and come out an atheist at the other end, because the evidence seemed to me to be so overwhelming and transparent and clear. I also, as an undergraduate, began to expose myself to people of other worldviews, people such as Muslims and atheists and so forth. And I became interested in the question of, well, how do we know Christianity is true as opposed to any other religion, or maybe no religion is true? And so that's how I got involved in that.
And you've, as well as obviously pursuing your academic interests and blogging, you've been involved in a few debates recently. I know that I listened to the sort of somewhat interrupted one that you did with a well-known atheist out in the States on the Atheist Experience. You were talking to Matt Dillahunty, who again is a former guest on this programme. You've also had one, I think, on the Dogma Debate Show
Is
this a sort of a new area that you're exploring, kind of getting involved in some of these wrangles and debates with non-believers?
Yeah, I've had a lot of experience talking to non-believers at an informal level, but I haven't done as many debates, and it's something I'd like to do more of, I guess, in the future.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks for coming on to have a discussion, debate, whatever we want to call it, on today's programme. And Elliot as well for being with us on today's programme. We'd like to hear from you if you're interested in what we're talking about today. Would you like to get in touch? Maybe email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And as I said, we'll be hearing some of your responses to recent programmes towards the end of today's show. You can also, of course, get in touch via Facebook, social media, Twitter, Twitter and so on, at UnbelievableJB. If you want to follow me on Twitter and tell me what you thought of today's programme, or Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. All of those links and more available from the Unbelievable site on the Premier Christian Radio website. That's PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable. You can leave a comment there. You can find links to the podcast, to past programmes and everything else besides. So that's a good place to go. We're talking today on Unbelievable about whether religion is based on unjustified belief, whereas science is based on evidence.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
My guests today on the programme are Elliot George and Jonathan McClatchy. Elliot, in the book, you start out, I think, in chapter one, saying that I think the way you put it is that religious belief, as far as you're concerned, is caused by a God-shaped hole in our brain. It's a side effect of evolution, effectively. You also kind of have a concern about the very word belief, don't you?
I do.
Do you want to just sort of describe what your concern is with the idea of belief per se?
Well, let me have a conversation with Jonathan over this. Ronald Reagan, he believed in astrology. Do you believe in astrology?
I do not believe in astrology.
There's a woman in Kansas who thinks she believes she's been abducted by aliens 8 times. Do you believe her?
I'm skeptical.
My children used to believe in Father Christmas. How do you feel about that?
I think there's good evidence that Santa does not exist.
So there you go. The word belief, it might be true to the holder of the belief, but the receiver of the assertion of belief is entitled to place their own opinion. We are all skeptical of others' beliefs. We all like to find out for ourselves. So belief is not the carrier of truth.
Okay, Jonathan, you've been asked a few questions already, but what's your response to this idea that belief is akin to, I suppose, believing in those kinds of things which do not necessarily equate to truth?
I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, if you go onto scientific literature database like PubMed.org or something like that, and you type in believe, you'll find scientists saying, you know, I believe this, we believe that. And that believe is based on evidence. I think in the book, you are right to distinguish between fact and belief. Facts don't change. Beliefs do change. Beliefs can correspond to facts or they cannot correspond to facts. Beliefs have to be fueled by evidence and rational inquiry. One has to and I think, you know, beliefs should be grounded in evidence. I do think the fact that, you know, to say that I believe something for me just means that I intellectually assent to a proposition.
So what you're saying there is you're using the word belief as an alternative synonym for think.
Yes, pretty much. I think this proposition to be true would be synonymous with I believe this proposition to be true. Correct. Mm-hmm.
What does belief mean to you then? Presumably that's not what you take it to mean.
No, Jonathan has just demonstrated the valuelessness of the word belief.
Really?
By showing us that you can replace it with think.
But I don't quite understand what the problem is with the word belief, because I don't know. I mean, do you believe what you've written in this book, Elliot? Or do you think what you've written in this book? I mean, I take it you believe things. You believe that what you've written is true. You believe that you're here today.
Let me tell you how I like to use the word belief. Since we've established that it doesn't have any relationship that's fixed with the concept of truth, I prefer to associate it with concepts, propositions that are uncertain. So, for example, I might say, I believe Tom is hiding in the garden. I don't really know, but I have a preferential choice to think that.
I would say, you know, I think I have grounds beyond reasonable doubt to think that you exist. I can't be certain you exist. I might just be a brain in a vat, for all I know. Maybe the universe was created 5 minutes ago in the appearance of age. I'm not certain to the contrary. Nonetheless, I think that I'm sure beyond reasonable doubt that that's not true. So I say I believe that the universe is ancient. I believe it's about 4.6 billion years old. That's the belief, which I think corresponds to reality.
Not the universe.
Did I say universe?
Yeah. You said universe.
Oh, sorry, I meant Earth. Right. The universe is approximately 13.8 billion years old. Yeah.
I mean, in that sense, okay, I don't want to spend too long sort of on definitions here, but I guess you're saying, Jonathan, look, belief is if I feel I've got good reason to think that something is true, then I believe it. Mm-hmm. But you seem to be feeling like, no, belief tends to correspond to things where there's not that level of certainty,
yes,
as far as you're concerned.
I would say, instead of belief, I would say evidence indicates that the universe is 13.8 billion years old.
Right. For instance, would you say you believe in evolution, or would you say evidence indicates that evolution is true?
Evidence indicates. There's plenty of evidence.
You wouldn't want to use the word belief in that sense.
No. The way I prefer to use the word belief is for hopeful uncertainties.
Okay. So, well, some might say evolution itself is a hopeful uncertainty, depending on your perspective. But anything to say just as we start to break open some other areas?
I do think a belief is merely a hopeful uncertainty. I think a belief, you know, the more evidence I have to support a proposition as being true, the more inclined I am to believe that proposition to be true. And so I think it's just a difference in semantics.
Well, let me tell you what's wrong with that. As evidence comes in, the balance is being tipped towards what you would say belief. I would say towards indicating that we have a fact. And when we've got a fact, we've got something which no longer needs believing. I mean, we don't have to believe in gravity. For example, let's do an experiment here. Let's all stop believing in gravity and go for a float. Not going to happen, is it? So what I'm saying is that facts are self-evident.
Mm.
They don't require belief. It's a redundant attitude in relation to facts. So as you go up your escalator of more and more evidence towards the top, which you would say you believe in, I would say you've fallen off the need to believe when you get there.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, there's many scientific propositions which I accept as being true, which are tentative by their nature.
And, yes, they're hypotheses.
Right. Evidence isn't always self-interpreting. And you have to, often there's evidence going for and against the theory in question. And so you have to look at the balance of evidence and investigate where it lies.
Yes, they're hypotheses. And it's perfectly okay to believe in your preferred hypothesis. It's a choice, like the God proposition is a choice.
So are you certain of anything besides your own existence?
No, I don't think there's any certainty.
So you believe everything because you said that belief is a center of proposition that falls short of certainty, correct?
So I can use belief for all these things I'm uncertain about.
Which is everything you've just said, is it not?
If you like, yes. I don't accept that there's 100% certainty about anything.
But well, as I understand it, though, Elliot, what you've just said is you don't like using the word belief, except because we should talk about things that are evident, self-evidently true. But you've just said the only thing that is self-evidently true is that you exist. So everything is actually then a belief by definition if it's not self-evidently true. Is that fair?
Not quite sure how to respond to that. We know that beliefs can be false, don't we?
Correct.
Yes. I mean, for example, the man who thought that the rope bridge was strong enough to support his weight and got to the middle and fell to his death, realized that his belief was misplaced. So what we have in the word belief is not what it says in the dictionary. In the dictionary it says a belief is a proposition that an individual holds to be true.
Hmm.
Well, they may hold it to be true, but the reality is it can be false.
Correct.
But holding something to be true doesn't mean, therefore, by definition it's true, does it, I suppose?
No. And you know, you can have evidence for something which you cannot be certain of. So I have evidence you exist because I trust my cognitive functions and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I don't have absolute proof that you exist. But nonetheless, I accept that proposition. And so in the way that you're defining the word belief, I am justified in believing you to exist, even though I cannot be certain that you exist.
I mean, at the end of the day, that's the way we go about life. We believe things on the basis of having enough evidence to think that we're probably justified in believing something. So it seems like you've got an almost too large a degree of the need for evidence if we can only say if things are true if they sort of are self-evidently true. As we've said, the only thing that we could really say that about is our own existence, which let's move beyond this, but it's an interesting place to start.
Yes, I'd like to replay this conversation, take out all the words belief and put in place the word think and see, you know, how necessary this word belief actually is.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's so many things where, you know, I think you even use the word belief at points in your book, Godbuster, but I don't think you can necessarily just replace it with the word think all the time.
How would you respond to the fact that if you search through the scientific literature, you find scientists saying, we believe this, we believe that, and it's based upon evidence, data, concrete facts?
Well, scientists are guilty of loose talk very often. It's a tightrope you've got to walk along being a scientist, and they fall off it quite a lot.
Well, look, let's leave it there for the moment. Well, I do want to talk about the central contention here, which is that effectively science is evidence-based and Christianity religion is just, if you like, quote-unquote belief-based. And I think maybe to make that clear, for the moment, we'll talk about unjustified belief, let's say.
Okay.
Jonathan, overall impressions of the book?
Yeah, I was actually fairly disappointed with the book. I've read a number of atheist publications, and one of the first things that struck me was that there's no citations, no references in the book.
Yes. Fair criticism. I didn't want to make it a textbook, though. I wanted it to be... You see, I've spent most of my life explaining things to teenagers, and I wanted it to be accessible to anybody with a reading age of, say, 8 or more.
Right.
And that sort of audience doesn't really want lots of bibliography.
Right. But you do make a lot of claims in the book, which I've struggled to find in any primary sources. So, for example, you make a number of errors, like you said that, you know, the Emperor Constantine, for example, made Christianity the state religion of the empire and sent some women to the Holy Land in search of evidence for Christianity. Whereas the Emperor Constantine did not, in fact, make Christianity the state religion of the empire. It was in 313 AD, you have the Edict of Milan, which granted religious freedom. It was not until the Edict of Thessalonica in 380, under the Emperor Theodosius I, the Nicene Christianity became the state religion of the empire. There's a number of other errors you make in the book as well, such as claiming that the Emperor Constantine edited the Bible in the 4th century. I cannot find that in any primary source.
Did I claim that?
I
don't think so.
I can pull up the quote if you'd like.
He assembled
didn't. The Council of Nicaea in 325 AD was to discuss the relationship between the Father and the Son in the context of the Trinity.
Right.
It wasn't until 397 AD at the Council of Carthage that the canon finally became. And that was, you know, Constantine died 337 AD, so that's a big time period. There's a number of trivial facts in the book as well, like the Quran is 7th century, not 6th century, and minor things like that as well. But even in terms of, you know, you list
I'd
out...
I'd be happy to change those in the next edition.
you list out the Ten Commandments in the book, and your source that you cite in text is Wikipedia, whereas you could have just gone to Exodus 20 and you cited that.
Well, I could, but there are lots of different versions of the Ten Commandments. Depending on the way you number them, you can have as many as 13 commandments if you wish.
Citations and errors aside, as far as you're concerned, Jonathan, overall response to the central thrust of the argument.
So the main point of the book, I think, was that, you know, science is based on evidence, facts, whereas religion is kind of subjective, based on belief and personal preference. Like, you like ice cream, I like chocolate, something like that.
We've just established that because
indeed.
Of
this is the argument you're making. That's the argument you're making. And you define faith in the book as a central proposition without evidence, in much the same way that you define belief. You said at one point in the book that confidence is not faith. But you don't mention the fact that the word confidence is in fact derived from the Latin con fides, which means with faith. Mm.
It's not how it's used, though, is it?
Well, I think biblically it is used in that way. I mean, the Greek word is pistis, which means trust. If you were to read, you know, Theophilus of Antioch in the 2nd century AD, one of the church fathers who wrote an apology, a letter to the pagan Autolycus, and he says, do you not know that faith is the leading principle in all matters? For what husbandsman can reap unless he first entrusts the seed to the earth? Or who can cross the sea unless he first entrusts himself to the boat and the captain? Or who can be healed unless he first entrusts himself to the care of the physician? If then the husbandsman entrusts the earth and the sail of the boat and the sick position, why then we not place confidence in God when he holds so many pledges at his hand?
That was very fast, but basically saying basically whenever we exercise faith, we trust something
exactly.
or someone.
So yeah. faith is...
I'm amazed at your ability to quote tracts of the Bible.
Well, that's not from the Bible. That's from an early church father. So
but it's even biblically, I mean...
on the subject of confidence...
Yes.
You're a research biologist.
Correct.
You must know how confidence is used in statistics.
I do.
That's quite different from faith.
Well, I think, if you read the Bible, Proverbs 14 verse 15, for example, I'm talking about the way word faith is used biblically, and I'm saying in the Bible, in Proverbs 14 verse 15, it says, a simple man believes everything, but the prudent gives thought to his steps. Okay? And so we are encouraged biblically to be rational.
Why are you focusing on the Bible here? There's lots of different ancient religious texts.
Mm-hmm.
Why not the Quran? Why not the Vedas? Why not the Gitas?
Right.
Why not the Torah?
Right.
Why not the Book of Mormon?
Right. Well, I've studied some of these, and I've studied, you know, the Quran quite a lot. And I read the Quran, and I read, for example, in Surah An-Nisa, verse 157, that it denies that Jesus was even put on the cross, he was even crucified and died. Mm-hmm. The Quran misrepresents Christian theology on the Trinity in particular. And so forth.
They think the Trinity makes Christianity into polytheism.
Yeah, that's suggested in Surah Al-Maida, verse 73, I believe. So
why do you say no to all those other texts and religions and yes to Christianity?
Well, the point I'm making
What's the difference?
Is that I believe that the Quran is demonstrably false, and I can make many arguments for that. I believe in the case of Christian worldview that there is good reason to believe the Christian worldview to be true. And so I could give many arguments for that. One of them would be, so first of all, we know Jesus existed. You know, the evidence for that is plain. I think you would agree with that, correct?
I have no problem with a carpenter's son.
Right, okay. And I think we can also establish historically that he claimed to be God, right? Would you agree?
There are writings that were written after his death by 30 or 40 years, which were written by people who didn't know him, weren't there.
Well, I would argue...
Those are very dubious sources.
Well, I would argue that the Gospels are either written by people who did know Jesus personally or by people who were close to people who knew Jesus personally.
You know about Chinese whispers, don't you?
Well, I do think this is really a good synonym. I don't think this is really a good thought experiment, analogy, illustration here. I think, you know, the New Testament documents are based upon source material which goes back very early indeed. And so, for example, in 1 Corinthians...
Do you know, we have source material today which is based on very close to the time of the event.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Daily Mail. Mm-hmm. Is it reliable?
Well,
Fox News.
You have to investigate these things on a case-by-case basis. I mean, for example, do you believe that Alexander the Great existed?
I think the evidence indicates that Alexander the Great existed.
And what evidence?
And all the Roman emperors and so on.
Right.
I'm not an expert on Alexander the Great. I don't have
The earliest biographies of Alexander
the Great. Unlike you, I haven't memorized tracts of history books.
But
what's
your
point? Know where to go to.
Yeah. What's your point, though, Jonathan?
Right. All I'm saying is that I think if you investigate the New Testament historically, that could be a whole debate in itself, but if you investigate the New Testament historically, I think that it holds up. I think that you can demonstrate certain propositions as being true, namely, Jesus existed, he died on the cross, he claimed to be God, and he proved it by rising from the dead. I think these propositions are well-grounded historically.
Okay, well, look, that's the brief answer. We don't have time to go into a full show on the resurrection. Mm-hmm. Fascinating as that would be. We'll come back in a moment's time. We're going to continue this discussion. We're asking today, is religion based on unjustified belief, whereas science is based on evidence? My Christian guest today is Jonathan McClatchy. My atheist guest is Elliot George. I'm Justin Briley. You're listening to Unbelievable, and we'll be back in just a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, we uncover the scandal of Christmas, why a story about a couple in poverty, low-life shepherds, and claims of a virgin birth still have the ring of truth today. Plus, unlikely singing sensation Susan Boyle talks to us about faith and fame. We ask, where is God in Downton Abbey? And we celebrate the extraordinary legacy of Billy Graham. All that, plus news, reviews, and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And I'm your host, Justin Brierley, this Saturday afternoon. Unbelievable, part of faith explored every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio. You can catch it again and find past programmes at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to other resources, including the Unbelievable Conference DVD from this year. Back in July, we had a wonderful day with several hundred people joining us at Westminster Central Hall. Some great speakers, teachers and thinkers as well. And if you want to watch and listen to the whole thing, it's available if you go to the website premierchristianradio.com/DVD if you want to order that. Don't forget as well that Faith Explored is brought to you in association with Christianity Magazine, and you can find out more about that by visiting christianitymagazine.com. Later on in today's programme, we're hearing some of your thoughts about recent editions of the programme. We've had a couple of sort of Christian discussions in the last couple of weeks, and we've got lots of your thoughts on those. We were going to be doing a discussion today. We were supposed to be doing a discussion on near-death experiences. Eben Alexander and Stephen Novella were due to join me. Unfortunately, due to events beyond my control, that was not able to happen. So we're postponing that for another week. So look out for that if you were hoping to hear from those two another time. My guests who are with me today are Elliot George. He's a retired science teacher and atheist. He's written a book called God Buster, Exorcises All Known Gods. And he says that science is evidence-based. Christianity is about beliefs. Well, we've been discussing that with Jonathan McClatchy, who's our Christian guest in the studio today. He's a PhD student in cell biology, and he believes that Elliot's book is flawed in a number of ways and says that, in actual fact, Christian belief is evidence-based and science itself lends support to the case for God. Well, let's talk about that, because I think this is an important area we need to get to, because you're both interested in science. You're a retired science teacher, Elliot. You obviously believe that science at some level, doesn't even have any reference to God, presumably. You just think that any concept of God is redundant as far as what science tells us. Whereas I know that from your background and research, you actually think there's strong evidence that Right. points towards design at some sort of cellular and cosmic level, Jonathan. How do you think, I'll start with you, Jonathan, and let you respond, Elliot. How do you think Elliot kind of deals with that in the book?
So I read your chapter on evolution in the book. There's an entire chapter on that particular topic. And one of my criticisms of that chapter was that you addressed criticisms that no credential biology makes against Darwinism. For example, you critiqued the argument, well, if we evolved from monkeys, why are there still monkeys and so forth, or that evolution is based on random chance. No one with any background in biology would make those arguments. And there are, in fact, credential biologists who would critique the neo-Darwinian synthesis and promote even intelligent design. And they use far more sophisticated arguments. And so my criticism, I guess, was, you know, if you want to critique a position, at least deal with the best arguments, not the weakest arguments. And so I guess that would be my main critique of that chapter.
Well, as I was saying earlier, the book is targeted at less educated people, if you like. I've been a teacher. I've been educating teenagers most of my life. And I also debate online, and I meet a lot of very ignorant people in parts of the world, you know, where on social media you come into contact with them. And I do meet those criticisms of evolution, and therefore I thought they needed refuting.
But could you not note that, yes, there are more sophisticated arguments than these? Because you seem to suggest that this is the sort of mainstream argumentation that's being offered or levelled against Darwinism.
Well, in my experience, it is. We get all sorts of debates that I have with people from the African continent, for example, or Central America and the Bible Belt, where they reveal their own lack of knowledge as soon as they open their mouths to criticize evolution. They say if we've come from chimpanzees, which of course we haven't.
Right, of course. We're cousins of chimpanzees, according to the
common
conventional
ancestor.
View.
Yes. So that's the first mistake they make. Their sentences are riddled with misconceptions. So they start with, if we've come from chimpanzees, why are there still chimpanzees? Well, you might as well say, why are there still worms?
Right.
If you're that ignorant.
Sure. But I guess Jonathan's concern is that you've claimed to have dealt with intelligent design by answering those arguments. But Jonathan's point is, well, those simply aren't the arguments actually of the intelligent design movement, presumably.
You also redefine the concept of Erdos' complexity as being essentially synonymous with William Paley's watchmaker argument from his natural theology. And in fact, irreducible complexity is somewhat different. Irreducible complexity is basically arguing that there are certain macromolecular machines which are performing a function, and there are a number of sub-functions performed by components, each of which needs to be contributed for the overall system to function as it does.
Unless each of the transitional stages conferred an advantage.
Let's just boil this down for people who maybe aren't. We've quickly gone to a sort of a certain level at this point in this. But you're saying that there are certain types of molecular machines in cells, Jonathan, this is what you study, I know, yourself, that have every evidence, as far as you're concerned, of having been designed for a purpose and that couldn't have arisen by a kind of the blind forces of Darwinian evolution.
That's a claim. It's not evidence.
Of course, it's a claim.
Your claim is you believe that these did arise by blind forces of evolution. No?
No.
No?
I make no claims.
Don't you?
I say, we don't know. Let's keep looking.
But in the book, you do claim that evolution is well established scientifically.
Oh, it's well established, yes.
Right.
Yes.
So you do believe in it. I say believe, but you know what I mean.
The evidence indicates that evolution is beyond doubt.
And the evidence is, therefore, that design is simply not an option as far as you're concerned. That
there is no evidence that there is a God who's done designing.
Well, obviously, you disagree with that.
Right.
You,
and in the book, you say, you know, if you get a new flu vaccine every year because you believe that the flu virus has changed, you believe in evolution. I don't know a single person, even the most, even the most fundamentalist creationist, young earth creationist, I don't know anyone who thinks that life doesn't change or adapt to environments. I've never met anyone who takes that view.
This is the micro versus macro evolution.
Well, you have to justify that the extrapolation is warranted. And I think that there's good evidence to suggest that it's not warranted.
Well, the fossil record is evidence that little changes can amass into big differences.
Well, the fossil record is interesting. I mean, if you look at the fossil record, first of all, you need to distinguish between pattern and process. So even a demonstration of universal common ancestry does not demonstrate the efficacy of the neo-Darwinian mechanism, right? So neo-Darwinism attempts to explain the pattern of hereditary continuity. Whereas I think that if you look at the fossil record, and I give you two examples. I'll give you one example just now. If you take the whale series, for example, going from Pachycetus into Hyas, Ambulocetus, all the way into Dorudon and Basilosaurus, you see that transition occurring within a very narrow window of time, within a space of, at very most, 9 million years, but probably much less than that.
9 million?
Yes, but if
that's narrow?
Yes, I think it's narrow when you consider the changes, that the massive feat of genetic rewiring that needs to be accomplished there. You need to have, for example, you need to reorientate the fetus because you need to give birth underwater. You need, a special... Go ahead.
You wanted to interrupt, John.
Well, I'm thinking that this may be going above the heads of our audience somewhat here. And what I want to say is that if there was creation, a question I'd like to ask you is, what's the difference between intelligent design and creation? But leaving that aside for the moment, if there was creation, then everything appears at once. And the fossil record isn't consistent with that. But the fossil record is consistent with a gradual change from early forms of life to later forms of life.
Right, but that's not the only type of thing you need to look at. There's other data which is bearing on this question. So, as I said, you know, the whale transition is one example. It's very, very rapid. You have...
I don't think 9 million years is very rapid.
Well, I actually think it is. I mean, especially when you factor in the equations of population genetics. So, for example...
Do you know how many generations there would have been in that space of 9 million years?
Well, whales have a, you have to adjust the population genetic equations based upon the generation turnover sizes and mm-hmm. the population sizes. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you look at that, and you, for example, whales need to have a concurrent heat exchange system because they're one of the only mammals that have the testes inside the body, mm-hmm. right next to the muscles generating heat during swimming. And so you have to actively cool down the gland, mm-hmm. which is done in a similar fashion to a modern refrigeration system by shunting cooled blood from the tail flukes to a nexus of arteries and veins that dissipates heat from the gland. And so you have this system which you have to have a change to get the testes inside the body. You have to have a change to get this whole concurrent heat exchange system. If you assume that only two mutations are necessary to accomplish that radical innovation in form. Richard Sternberg, who is an evolutionary biologist, has calculated that you would need approximately 43.3 million years for that to occur. That's just one of the changes, and that's based
upon... to boil this down, you're saying, as far as you're concerned, the standard Darwinian model simply does not account for the complexity and changes over time that we do apparently see in the fossil record.
That's correct.
The point you wanted to bring up, though, John, is, hang on, isn't creation about everything appearing at once, whereas at least in the fossil record we may disagree about how it happened, speaking of Darwinian evolution, but it certainly doesn't show that everything showed up at the same time.
I don't think you need to posit that. I mean, I'm an intelligent design theorist. I think that, intelligent design can simply be defined as the proposition that certain features of biological systems bear hallmarks of an intelligent cause.
So how is it different from creationism?
So creationism is normally derived from a holy text such as Genesis 1 and a particular interpretation of that religious text. Intelligent design is more minimal in its claims. It claims that, life exhibits design. It doesn't necessarily, it's not derived from a religious text.
Okay, so does creationism include intelligent design, or are we assuming that God created things unintelligently for creationism?
Well, I'd say that you cannot be a creationist without also being an intelligent design proponent. Yes. But not all intelligent design
proponents
are creationists.
So let's call a spade a spade, shall we?
Well, no, not all intelligent design proponents are creationists.
I'll tell you why intelligent design is being used as an expression nowadays. It's to avoid the laws forbidding the teaching of creationism in American states.
I'm afraid that's not true, and I can tell you why it's not true, because the Discovery Institute from very early on has opposed, as its education policy, the promotion of the mandating of intelligent design in public schools.
This is the Discovery Institute?
In Seattle, Washington.
Yes, it's a Christian organization. And
no, it's not. It's actually a secular organization.
All right.
Yes, and the Discovery Institute is the central think tank, which is and many of the intelligent design scientists around the world are affiliated with Discovery Institute.
Oh.
For example, Discovery Institute opposed...
So we're talking about a biased source here then, aren't we?
Well, labs have biases. Labs are investigating particular questions, and they're investigating, is the evidence supporting this? And labs, people who work in laboratories come to conclusions. I, in my lab, I form a hypothesis, and then I go seek out to investigate it, set up controls and so forth, and verify it. And I think the same is going on in the intelligent design community. If the evidence went the other way and started suggesting that, in fact, neo-Darwinian mechanisms were causally sufficient to explain what needs to be explained, I would change my mind.
You see, science doesn't work like that. We don't start out with a presupposition and then look for ways to justify it. We start out with a question and investigate for evidence to examine the question.
Oh, I think we do that. But you do, as evidence comes in, people who work as a team in the lab will come to a particular conclusion, that hypothesis that they've suggested is correct. And then they will continue to investigate that hypothesis further. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
I mean, as far as you're concerned, though, what it boils down to is you believe that the evidence from science does point to a creator, a designer. You believe there's no such reason to take such a
Can I state my position?
Yeah, please do, Elliot.
My position is that the God proposition is one hypothesis which sets out to offer an explanation for our ignorance. I'm not saying there is no God. I'm saying we need to look for evidence for a God. Right. Now, you're saying we don't know, therefore God.
I would say, actually, that's not a fair representation of my position. So let me just very quickly explain what my position is and why I think it's true. So you have to distinguish between the way that, you know, operational science is done and the way that historical science is done and the different methodologies that these different lines of inquiry are based on. So when we're dealing with historical questions, such as what happened in the past or the origin of life and so forth, we're dealing with, we're using a method called the abductive method. And the abductive method traces its origin back to Charles Lyell in his Principles of Geology, which Charles Darwin, of course, read.
Yeah.
And he insisted that the present is the key to the past. In other words, if you want to explain things which happened in the past, you should extrapolate from present causes to past effects, past causes. And so when we're dealing with intelligent design, we're saying, you know, what's the one type of cause, one category of explanation which we ordinarily conclude when we see information, whether we're reading, you know, a newspaper headline or a hieroglyphic inscription or computer programming language or something like that, and it uniformly, information uniformly traces its source back to an intelligent cause. Thus, when we find information inherent in the hereditary molecules of DNA and RNA, it follows that the most probable, likely candidate explanation is that it too arose by virtue of an intelligent agent.
So, what you have just said amounts to making a proposition that there is a God.
Well,
not evidence that there is a God.
Hang on. What would ever count as evidence then if we're not using propositions and that kind of thing? I mean, you believe whatever in the theory of evolution, and that is based on propositions and bits of evidence and everything else. But this is exactly the same mode that presumably Jonathan is relying on to come to a design conclusion, if you like.
Well, what we've got to think about here is what is actually evidence. And I contend that ancient religious texts are not sources of information.
But we're not talking about that just now.
No. Okay. Right. I'm just listing the things
sure.
that are not evidence. It's easier to say what is not evidence than to say what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm saying that books are not evidence.
Well, they can be for some things, surely.
Indeed.
For history, for instance.
Indeed. Well, history is based mostly on inference rather than evidence, except where there is physical remains, in which case science can come in and date them.
And Darwinism is an historical proposition based upon inference as well, right?
In some respects, but there's so many strands of evidence for evolution. I don't think even Darwin would like it to be called Darwinism.
Right. Well, when I say Darwinism, I mean, you know, the unguided nature of evolution.
The books that you talk about as being good sources of evidence have been validated or verified. I mean, the telephone directory is a great source of reliable information, and you can check it just by making a few telephone calls and seeing whether the person listed picks up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a science textbook is also a good source of evidence because you can repeat the experiments it describes and check whether you get the same results as recorded.
Right.
But that's what books are. They're records. And unless they have been verified in the manners I've suggested, they are not trustworthy sources of information. Otherwise, we might as well say Harry Potter. In fact, come back in 2,000 years and there'll probably be a Harry Potter religion.
But there are historical methodologies that historical scholars use to investigate historical propositions.
Yes, so, based on science.
So, right. So, for example, if you know, the criterion of embarrassment would be one example, right? So, for example, Jesus in Mark 13 and Matthew 24 says, "No one knows the day to the hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." That, historians would say, is likely to be historically authentic saying of Jesus because it's unlikely to have been invented by the Christians.
Okay, a historian might say that, a scientist wouldn't. Let me go on.
But that's why scientists are scientists and historians are historians. They are different fields of inquiry.
Right.
But are you saying that historians are don't arrive at truth because they're not scientists?
I love history, but it's stuff that's been written, and writers have an agenda. And it's difficult to
separate.
Whereas
no scientist would ever have an agenda, obviously.
Well, I wouldn't make that claim. But have you read scientific works? They're extremely boring because, of course, opinion has to be kept out of them.
Well, it depends which one you read, I think.
Well, yeah, scientific opinion is found all throughout science. So I read a lot of science literature, and it's just not true to say there's no opinion there.
No, but it's the place for opinion and belief in science is at the hypothesis stage. It's pre the investigation. We can have our belief in our favourite hypothesis, then we put it through the sausage machine of investigation. What pops out is an evidence.
Right.
Conclusion.
But science isn't the only way of knowing things. Would you agree with that?
It's the best way of discovering new information.
So you don't include history as a legitimate subject?
I do include it as a legitimate subject, but I regard it as being less evidential than science.
I think it certainly is dependent upon different methodologies, but I think that, you know, I think that there's evidence beyond to justify assent beyond reasonable doubt that, for example, Caesar Augustus existed.
Yeah, there's plenty of statues.
Right, and
those are physical evidence. You see, what we're talking about here is corroborating evidence from another source, not just a book, but another source, a statue.
The New Testament is comprised of 27 different books, and you know, many of these are independent. So, for example, the book of John is independent of the Synoptics,
yes.
And Paul's writings are independent of the Gospels.
Yes, yes, and Acts and so on.
Yes.
And what about the Gospels that didn't get included?
Well, yeah, there's a different discussion as well. I mean, I've read...
What are your criteria for saying this is a good Gospel and that's not?
Well, the early church had certain criteria, and they were, you know, apostolicity. They had to be written by an apostle. They had to be...
I know.
Yeah. You cannot make an argument for any gospel besides the four in the canon that they are first century or written by an eyewitness or someone credible.
No, indeed. So what you're saying there is you're devaluing the evidential status of the gospels.
Of later gospels, which are more likely to have... been embellished and
the other gospels are second and third century and have a very clear Gnostic Greco-Roman influence.
Yes. And the earlier gospels are 30 or 40 years after the death of Christ.
So, well, yes, but they are based on source material that does go back very early. And that is very early.
But this is just the act of doing history. It's called New Testament history, but there's a very established, you know, academic way of doing
theology.
It. But the point is, you seem to be sort of saying, well, we simply can't know with any kind of certainty about those types of things compared to the certainty we have with science.
Absolutely.
It's effectively the claim
science
you're making.
Science is the gold standard.
Other ways of acquiring knowledge are sort of substandard to
indeed.
Do that.
Yeah, and we've just landed a probe on a comet 300 million miles away to prove how effective scientific evidential gathering methods are.
Right. I mean, but the question is, I suppose, does all this mean that, therefore, we have much less reason to believe in God to believe in established scientific facts?
Well, I say that scientific facts do not require belief.
Right.
It's only scientific, well, any hypothesis or proposition, assumption, guess, you know. I can believe my horse is going to win the 4:30 at Chepstow. That's where the use of belief should be.
But you've already established that you don't think anything is certain besides your own existence, right? So everything is a belief for you, apart from your own existence.
Well, I prefer my solid foundation of evidential, indicated facts.
Right.
And on top of that, I'm happy to be ignorant.
But can scientists disagree about what the science supports?
At the hypothesis level, certainly.
But you can, you know, I see papers published in Nature or published in Journal of Cell Biology or what have you, and they contain, often they don't interpret the data in the way that I would interpret it, perhaps.
Yeah.
And this is
one of the benefits of science, isn't it?
Right.
It's peer-reviewed.
Right. And often a new hypothesis, which first emerges in the literature, for a while, you know, it's disagreed about, discussed, people debate, and eventually, if the evidence keeps coming in to corroborate, then it's accepted.
Part of the process of science.
Right.
But eventually, a consensus of expert opinion is formed, and at that stage, is put on the shelf.
Right.
And it's a known fact until it's not completely closed because, you know, something new observation may occur in future. Mm-hmm. And in which case we dust it off and have another look. And we might have to rethink our attitude towards that information.
Right.
This doesn't happen in religion.
So let's go back to what we were talking about earlier concerning intelligent design and the methodology that we use to infer that intelligent agent is responsible for the origins and development of life on Earth. I talked about the abductive historical method, and I'm wondering, do you agree with one of the premises of the argument? Do you agree with the logical structure of the argument? Where would you disagree with my conclusion?
You're talking about the past is the secret to the present and future.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's well proven, isn't it? I mean, take geology, for example. We can investigate, based on our knowledge of how sedimentary rocks form in sequence, historically, and as a result of that knowledge, we can discover oil.
Right.
Right. So concerning intelligent design and the way I've used that methodology to infer that as the best explanation, how would you deal with that?
I would say that what you've discovered is an area of ignorance. We don't know how these complex mechanisms originated.
But I'm arguing that there's a positive inferential basis to say that an intelligent agent was responsible, right?
That's a proposition.
No, I said that there's an historical methodology, and we know from all of our present uniform repeated experience, if you will, of cause and effect, that information always comes from an intelligent source. And when I find information in the DNA molecule, I infer it too had an intelligent source.
Well, what about, take for example, the, what are they called? The Giant's Causeway. It looks as, you know, are you familiar with the Giant's Causeway?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. It's a geological structure off the coast of Ireland. And these are rocks which are hexagonal. Look to all intents and purposes to have been man-made or by some intelligent agent. But we know that they have been formed as a result of volcanic activity, and lots of things are formed as a result of natural processes.
Right.
There is no reason to take the imaginative leap from here is something complex to therefore God.
I think there's a qualitative difference between looking at these structures and looking at information, and the way I'm defining information in this sense is specify complexity. So it's not only immensely improbable, more so than can be afforded by the probabilistic resources, but is also specific in that it conforms to some independently given pattern. And I don't think you could make that argument for the Giant's Causeway, whereas you can for DNA.
We're going to take a break. Interesting stuff. We've spoken at some length in this section of the programme on intelligent design, something that you believe does point, Jonathan, to a designer, obviously, hence the name, something that obviously you take issue with, Elliot. It's been really interesting. We're going to get to some kind of a resolution towards the end of today's recording. We're going to take a quick break now, and I'll be back with my guests, Elliot George and Jonathan McClatchy, as we continue to debate belief and evidence, science and faith, on another edition today of Unbelievable. Do join us again in a moment's time. Hello, welcome back to the third part of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the programme that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon on Premier Christian Radio. Certainly have been aiming to do that with my guests in studio with me this Saturday afternoon. They are Elliot George and Jonathan McClatchy. We're going to be concluding my discussion with them in just a moment's time on belief, evidence, science, faith and so on. If you want to find out more about today's show, my guests, then do go to the website of today's programme, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can find out more about Jonathan at crossexamine.org/blog, where he's a regular blogger at the website of Frank Turek. If you just look on Amazon, really, for Godbuster, you'll find out more about Elliot George's book there. Next week on Unbelievable, we're going to be doing something that we've covered to a little bit on today's show. We're talking about Christianity on trial. Mark Lanier is a pretty high-flying trial lawyer out in the US, and he's joining me in my studio next week. He's a Christian, and he's written a book called Christianity on Trial, why he believes the evidence supports Christianity, both in the documents and in the evidence for God and so on. Paul Beaumont is going to be our non-Christian guest. He was a Christian, but he abandoned his faith after coming under the influence of atheists like Richard Dawkins questions and so on. So it should be a really interesting discussion. Christianity on Trial, that's at the same time next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking every week. Unbelievable. Don't forget also that later on today you can hear The Profile, and you're going to be hearing from a young up-and-coming comedienne between 4 and 5. So listen out for that as well. And if you're still around towards the end of today's programme, you'll be hearing some feedback. Perhaps you've written in and you'll be hearing something of what you had to say in regard to recent programmes. For the moment, let's conclude our discussion between my guests Elliot George and Jonathan McClatchy.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So, gentlemen, we've been talking at some length about intelligent design in the last section of the programme and why Jonathan believes it does provide evidence for design, why the evidence from biology, at least, gives us good reason to infer a design hypothesis. You've said, I think, in response, essentially, that as far as you're concerned, we just don't know, and that it's sort of throwing in the towel or something, I suppose, to infer design.
No, not throwing in the towel.
John.
We're happy to investigate.
Happy to investigate. I wonder what would eventually allow you to accept a design hypothesis. I mean, what would you have to see to accept that the cells, you know, that biology was a product of an outside designer in that sense? Would there be anything that could convince you of that?
Yes. If you find a watch in the desert, you're finding a watch.
Mm-hmm.
You need to look for a watchmaker.
Okay.
Let's find a watchmaker before we make the conclusion.
But isn't that precisely what Jonathan is suggesting, that there is this same kind of intricacy in design and purposefulness in the information in the cell that you would find in, let's say, a watch that caused you to think, well, there must be a watchmaker?
Well, as I said earlier, there are lots of things that are made by natural causes. The Grand Canyon, the White Cliffs of Dover. Why are we not looking for a White Cliff of Dover maker?
Well, I think in some cases, like if you look at Mount Rushmore, for example, in South Dakota, you mm-hmm. do see, you know, evidence of design. Mm-hmm. There's the president's faces are carved into the cliff face. That's radically different from just a normal cliff face.
Well, we know that those have been man-made.
Right.
But in the case of DNA, we don't know that.
But suppose you were to send a man to Mars, let's say, and he was to discover, you know, a pile of machinery or a hieroglyphic inscription or something like that. He would infer, say, you know, it's said on Mars, you know, made in China or something, and you would infer that this is the product of design, not merely wind and erosion.
You use the word infer. It's not evidence. It's an inference.
Well, inferences can be based on evidence.
I want to find the Chinese man who made Mars before I'll accept.
All kinds of things that we believe are a result of inference based on particular types of evidence.
Do you know who made your computer at home?
Apple.
Right. Do you know the individual who made it?
No.
Then how can you infer that it's a product of design?
Well, we do. There's plenty of evidence to show that computers have been made by men.
Right.
We know the whole...
So you're inferring that your computer is therefore made by a man or woman.
Or when I read your book, I infer that an intelligent agent, namely Elliot George, wrote the book, right? And I hadn't met you before today, but I nonetheless inferred because I saw the arrangement of the ink on the pages and so forth, and it conferred intelligence.
Well, it's nice to meet you. I really do exist. But let's meet God, and then we'll know that he did the intelligent designing.
We've reached an impasse on intelligent design. I can see that. We won't pursue that any further. I think you wanted to bring something as we start to close out today's programme, a sort of a statement about where you stand on this whole issue of belief and evidence.
I have a sort of summary, if you like.
Go ahead.
Historically, belief was important. It served us well. Belief that the unknown might be dangerous, for example, was a beneficial adaptation. Belief used to have high value. Thousands of years ago, there were many beliefs. We believed in dragons, unicorns, mermaids, spirits, and thousands of gods. Few support those beliefs today. So we all form our own opinion about the beliefs of others. Only the holder of the belief thinks they are true. Belief is subjective. We know beliefs can be false. So that means that all beliefs are just suppositions. And reflective people even realise that their own beliefs are dubious. Justin Welby recently publicly revealed his doubts about God. Beliefs are not facts. Thousands of years ago, beliefs were our only source of information because we didn't know about evidence. It's true that mankind had stumbled on some real facts by experience or by accident, but we had no formalized process for distinguishing fact from fantasy. Today, we do. We have scientific method. Belief has been superseded by evidence. We can distinguish fact from fantasy now. Belief no longer has the value it had in the past. And evidential facts do not require believing. Gravity obeyed the inverse square law long before men evolved to believe in it. And it's been unaffected by the extinction of 90% of the species that have ever existed, so we can be fairly confident that it will continue to obey the inverse square law after mankind has become extinct.
Well, that's a very eloquent statement. Do you believe it?
The evidence indicates that it's likely to be true.
Right. Anything to say in response?
Nice try there, Justin. I think that, you know, yes, he's right to distinguish between beliefs and facts. Facts don't change. Facts are true regardless of whether someone believes them to be true. Beliefs do change and are subject to evolution as new evidence
opinion.
Is acquired.
Opinion.
Well, I think that, you know,
choice.
I think that belief, I would just simply define belief as assent to a propositional claim, and it may be correct or it may be incorrect.
Assumption okay. of a propositional claim.
And I think that Christian belief is based on evidence. I think there's good evidence for Christianity. I think that you cannot explain the dynamics of Christianity's origin, why it came into being and took the very precise shape and structure and form that it did without the resurrection.
That's ignorance.
Is it though? I mean, you believe all kinds of things, don't you, Elliot?
I believe my horse will win the 4:30 at Chepstow.
Yeah, but you also believe things like that. The sat nav that you used to get here or whatever would
well,
work.
The evidence indicates that it does.
Yeah, but that's exactly what Jonathan is saying. He believes there's good evidence for him to believe that Jesus Christ was who he said he was and rose from the dead or whatever. But you're saying
we didn't finish discussing evidence. Well, maybe another time.
Maybe another time. I just don't understand why you insist that the only things worth kind of holding to are scientifically proven things, when in fact we trust in all kinds of ways.
A man might say, you know, I believe that my wife loves me, or a man might say, you know, to his wife, I love you, and his wife says, I believe you. Does that mean that it's not based on evidence?
Those are subjective opinions, aren't they?
Well, I'd say that, you know, a man's, you know, belief that his wife loves him is based upon evidence. Otherwise, presumably, he would not be married to that person. But I think biblically,
evidence indicates that a lot of marriages are mistaken in that respect.
But people can base beliefs. People's beliefs cannot be rationally justified as well. But simply the fact that you have a belief doesn't entail one way or the other whether it's rationally justified. And indeed, I think biblically.
So it's not very valuable then.
Well, as I was going to say, I think biblically, you know, we are instructed to have an intellectually responsible foundation for our worldview. 1 Peter 3:15 says that to always be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that lies within you, but doing so with gentleness and respect. So that is
What's wrong with quoting something? Because obviously you've quoted from the Bible in the book, Elliot, and obviously Jonathan thinks that you've rather misattributed quite a lot of those quotes, and he thinks that when the Bible does talk about faith and belief, it's talking about in the context of evidence, and that there's no need to do this thing that you say of, you know, divorcing religious Christian beliefs specifically from evidence, that his beliefs are firmly tied to evidence as far as he's concerned, and simply saying no, belief is subjective, that's just not what Jonathan says. He says there is evidence, and I'm justified in believing in God because of the evidence.
We never established why he chose the Bible.
Well, that's a whole debate in itself, and I would be happy to come back and debate you on that topic alone, if you'd like. But I think, you know, I talked about the resurrection. I think there's good evidence for the divine self-understanding of Jesus, that he in fact predicted his coming death and subsequent resurrection, and that he confirmed his divine self-claims by returning from the dead. I think there's very profound historical evidence for that proposition.
We're going to have to leave it there. But it's been fun. It's been great
it
fun,
has.
Actually.
Yeah.
So thank you for... There's shaking hands in front of me. You can't see that, but you'll have to take my word for it. The evidence is you'll have to rely on is my words.
I'll hit him with my book after we've gone off air.
Well, I know you guys are off to go and have some lunch now, so I hope that the conversation continues. Thanks for joining me on the programme today. If you want to get hold of God Buster by Elliot George, links from today's programme at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and I'll link certainly to Jonathan McClatchy's blog as well, where you can find out more about what he does and some of his recent thinking as well. Jonathan and Elliot, thanks for being with me today.
Justin, it's been fun. Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So if you want to get in touch with the programme, as ever, unbelievable@premier.org.uk to send me an email. I'll be reading some of yours in just a moment's time from people like Chuck and Kenneth and Michael and others. And if you want to get in touch via the Unbelievable Facebook or Twitter page, @UnbelievableJB to follow on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. I update those regularly with what's going on the programme, interesting links and all the rest of it, so you can keep in touch that way. And of course, the website gives you links to all of those as well. The website of Unbelievable gives you links to our podcast feed. Now, we've been doing some updating of that in the last few weeks, and if you're a regular podcast listener, you may have noticed that you've suddenly had an extra bunch of downloads in your on your machine or on your iPod or whatever. That apologies for that. It's one of the factors of moving to a new RSS feed, as it's called. We're also ironing out some issues that we've discovered in the process of doing that, that not all Android users are receiving it in a very helpful way. It's trying to download it as a video instead of an MP3 and things. We're trying to sort that out. So apologies if you are experiencing any delays on receiving it via podcast. You can, of course, always go to the main website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, to listen there via the player. And I'm including links to the MP3 where you can download it, save it to your computer or whatever. So lots of options, and always worth trying if you have difficulty listening on one platform like Internet Explorer, trying it on Chrome or Mozilla or whatever. But thanks for those who have been getting in touch, raising one or two areas where they've been having trouble, and we are trying to address them as quickly as we can in what is an overall fairly complex website system where everything has to be integrated. So that's why we're having to move things along a bit. Also, some of you may have been coming today expecting, as I said earlier, to hear that conversation on the near-death experience of Ibn Alexander. We sort of heard the first part of that, if you like, from him last week, and I promised a show between him and Stephen Novella. Well, unfortunately, due to unforeseen circumstances, we weren't able to do that show this week, but we will be rescheduling that. In fact, planning on a couple of episodes. I've been promising them for a while, but a couple of episodes on near-death experiences with several guests, actually, to come. So we'll try to make sure those happen before the end of this year, certainly. Thanks to people who have been emailing in, like Chuck, who's emailing from San Francisco, California, says, "I recently discovered Unbelievable, your radio program. I've been having a great time exploring the archives. I like the open-minded, intelligent way that you engage with your guests. I've noticed, however, that the Christians on your show, who I've heard so far, rarely make any mention of the inner life or of having a meaningful personal relationship with God or Jesus. The debates about the existence of God focus mostly on external or logical evidence or the lack thereof. I would think that the day-to-day experience of divine companionship would be the first thing a Christian would mention. This might not be convincing to an atheist, but it would certainly be edifying for other believers. Are Christians not having an inner spiritual relationship with God these days, or are they simply afraid to admit it and talk openly about it, especially in Britain?" Well, Chuck, and if you've listened to today's programme, it would be no exception to that, to what you've heard in terms of a sort of fairly forensic, objective kind of debate about evidence for God rather than talking about the inner spiritual life. And in a sense, that is because it is a show that deals with apologetics, which generally is about those objective external evidences, if you like, the rational arguments for Christianity and for God. That's not to say, of course, that those guests who come on and do that as from a Christian perspective don't have that inner spiritual life. I'm sure they do. It's just, I guess, in the context of many of the debates that we tend to talk about in the context of this programme, that doesn't tend to crop up so much. Of course, if you listened to Premier Christian Radio across the rest of the week and not just for the 1.5 hours of Unbelievable, you will find many people talking about relationship with God and the importance of the spiritual life and so on, devotional life, the spiritual disciplines and everything in between. So if you're not a listener of the rest of our schedule, perhaps you listen just via the internet to the podcast, why not check it out? There's lots and lots of stuff going on. So we're not quite as dry and academic as you might think just from listening to this podcast. Chuck, thank you for emailing in. Kenneth, Lit Walk, you say it's a long A, as in walk or water. So this is Ken Lit Walk, says, I enjoyed the programme featuring Peter Enns and David Instone Brewer. Peter Enns, as usual, trying to have his cake and eat it too. In his book, Inspiration in Incarnation, he describes the Old Testament as the record of people trying to understand God and their world. In The Evolution of Adam, he explicitly states that Paul was wrong about his belief in Adam, which would then require logically that Paul's teaching based upon Adam was wrong as well. Then, last Saturday, on Unbelievable, he expressed serious doubt about the historical value of the Bible. Given all that, his fideist position, Jesus' atoning death and bodily resurrection, are matters to accept on faith. Well, it sounds like Enns is advocating faith in spite of understanding. If all that is said about the Bible is correct, there's no sane reason to believe anything in it. Yet, Enns keeps affirming this. It sounds more like the claims of someone who believes the earth is flat, in despite of describing the evidence that proves it's not, than a responsible Christian view of Scripture. That's one view of that discussion between Peter Enns and David Instone Brewer. Here's a different perspective from Bill in Ohio, who says, I'm a Protestant convert to Eastern Orthodoxy. I was very pleased to hear your recent program on Orthodoxy, and with that in mind, couldn't help but think that your more recent show featuring Peter Enns and David Instone Brewer was simply screaming for a third perspective. Both gentlemen were clearly arguing from within the modern evangelical tradition, which can be broadly defined to include nearly anything that isn't Roman Catholic tradition. The heart of the discussion was the frankly quite modern evangelical view of inerrancy. N.T. Wright was referenced as having once commented that the view of inerrancy in America is much stronger than in England. This says to me that evangelical notions of inerrancy are themselves a tradition. So my point is this, in almost all Protestant debates, despite the appeals on all sides to be simply adhering to Scripture alone, what is really being debated is tradition. Particular views of inerrancy are traditions. I'm going to skip forward a little bit in your email here, Bill. The irony to me, and a big reason why I could no longer continue in the Reformed Protestant world, is that while Protestants hold up sola scriptura as some sort of antidote to tradition, sola scriptura itself is a tradition. The Reformers didn't sweep away tradition and replace it with Scripture. Rather, they swept away one set of traditions about Scripture and replaced it with another set of traditions about Scripture. So you feel that the Peter Enns debate is just feeding into that. What you'd love to hear is more Orthodox guests bringing their perspective on these things. Thank you very much for getting in touch. Let's talk about last week's programme now. That was Just War and Pacifism. Two spectacular speakers joined me for that. Stanley Havas on the pacifist side and Nigel Bigger on the Just War position. Here's a couple of comments coming in underneath that show from last week on the website. Adam Clark says, great discussion, Justin and co. You may also be interested in a discussion around Christian anarchism, which in a nutshell emerges from pacifism and rejects the violence of government. I'm sure Dr. Alex Christoianopoulosis would enjoy discussing the theological position on your show. And here's Michael, who says, another programme out of your top drawer, Justin. That was the most thoughtful discussion about Christianity and war I have come across. As a slight aside, one of the highlights of the program for me was when you asked Nigel whether he thought the atomic bombs dropped on Japan could be considered justified. His reply of I don't really know was such a refreshing change to the usual reluctance of Christian debaters and apologists to show any signs of uncertainty in their own position. The program has made me want to read more from both of the contributors. Thank you for bringing us this excellent program. Glad you enjoyed it too, Michael. But not everyone was as pleased with how it went. Here's one from Aaron, who says, really appreciate your show. I've been listening for about 4 years. I was so looking forward to this debate. However, I was disappointed. Even the gentleman supporting the non-violent view didn't press his view much through the lens of Scripture, let alone Jesus. I hail from the States, and my last 14 years as a Christian could have been considered right-wing and conservative, as well as the just war view of Christianity. However, in the past year, I had to let Jesus reform my thinking. I saw my past, the American version of Christianity, and Christ turning on its head what Jesus really meant. Hope you take the topic up again. You know, Greg Boyd would be a perfect person to address the non-violent view. Thank you, Aaron. Sorry that it didn't live up to your expectations. But here's another one here from someone who says, warmongering is neither a theory nor is it just. This is Matt Rubenstein in Berlin. Says, leaving aside the irony that hard-nosed just war theorist Nigel Bigger turned out to be the opening act on your show for a guest who believes that while comatose he flew with a beautiful girl on a butterfly wing, I feel obliged to intervene in a debate that really shouldn't concern me. As an atheist, it's of no matter to me which position is the more truly Christian, pacifism or just war theory, but I've seldom heard a guest on your show utter so many falsehoods amounting to a kind of moral lunacy as the decidedly non-pacific Mr. Bigger. Stanley, however, showed his aversion, at least to verbal violence, by his almost Christ-like demeanour in the face of his warmongering interlocutor. For Mr. Bigger, the just before war evidently turns out to mean any and all, so long as the United States or Britain is prosecuting it. Clearly, any just war theory worthy of the name should involve placing serious constraints on the scope of morally permissible wars. Nothing of the sort seems to apply in Nigel Bigger's moral universe. Key points here were his refusal to condemn the atomic bombings in Japan by any reckoning the most efficient acts of mass murder in human history, and recognised by all but the staunchest Anglo-American nationalists to have had no military value whatsoever. Then there was his insinuation that those who opposed the illegal war in Iraq were somehow ignorant of Iraqi society or insensitive to the plight of its people. And this, although Mr. Blair's aggression to date has caused something of the order of a million Iraqi deaths, has led to the utter destruction of Iraq as a modern state and society, and has fostered the total barbarism that has now coalesced in the form of IS. Mr. Havas was quite the pacifist indeed when he allowed Mr. Bigger to pose as a realist by poo-pooing the idea that the United States have an addiction to war. Surely, either you or Mr. Havas might have pointed out that denying reality doesn't make you a realist. In my lifetime, the United States has invaded or dropped bombs on at least 10 countries, not counting drone wars and special ops conducted in several other various wars by proxy. Anyway, thank you for calling in, for writing in, Matt. I appreciate that you disagreed strongly, obviously, with Nigel Bigger's view on just war. OK, so maybe just time for one more email. Here's Mark Baster, who says, great programme on just war. Firstly, we honour the dead and their families with complete sincerity always. I believe Jesus to be far more radical than just war theories. There can never be a just war. It is just war. No remote romantic idealism can compete with the horror, carnage and devastated lives. To have a theory is in itself a scandal. It's a false and emotive trick to always cite the simplistic scenario of a murderer breaking in to destroy your family. We would all shield our family while hopefully displaying a Jesus-sanctified restraint. But one foe is not a nation. This becomes a moral minefield which no theory can sanitize. God says vengeance is mine because he knows we can't achieve true justice. Thank you very much for getting in touch, and sorry I can't read all of the emails that came in on that subject, but I do appreciate those who have sent in their thoughts. Thanks for being with me this week on Unbelievable. Time to leave you in the hands of Lady T, who's speaking to Angie Lamar on The Profile next up here on Faith Explored. But if you join me again for Unbelievable at the same time next week, let me tell you what you can expect then.
You're unbelievable.
I'm going to be joined by Mark Lanier and Paul Beaumont. Mark is a trial lawyer in the US, quite a successful one too. Well, he's written a book as a lawyer looking at the case for Christianity. It's called Christianity on Trial, and he's going to be in conversation with Paul, who is now a non-Christian, having once been one, and they're going to be debating whether Jesus Christ really was the Son of God, as he claimed to be, whether he really rose from the dead, and more besides. Hope you can come back for that at the same time next week. It's going to be another enthralling episode, I can assure you. Until then, have a great week.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.